Hello, listeners, and welcome to the eighth and final part of The Vanishing Season, a novella written by Katie Darby and read by Katie Darby. I hope you've enjoyed the ride so far. The story so far. Summer, 1892. James Emerson, a Cambridge historian, has gone to see his old friend Chester Whittingstall, who recently discovered a medieval doom painting at the church where he is vicar, St. Peter's, Weniston, in Suffolk. Arriving, he finds Chester gone. Emerson views the painting, sketching some of the figures Oxborrow, the verger, says may be Woodwows, hairy wild men, and falls into a sort of trance, missing his train. Forced to stay overnight, he thinks he sees a feral, hunched, man-like shape sitting atop a new-dug grave. Next morning, he dismisses it as a dream, but then sees a naked footprint in the fresh soil. Thinking Chester may have gone to the village of Hartist to discover the identity of the doom artist, he decides to follow, hiring a horse and gig. But it seems that something preternaturally swift is also following him, and a breathless chase ends in his crashing his vehicle. Limping into a local pub, he discovers from a barmaid the true nature of the vanishing season, when young men all over the county begin to disappear just after midsummer. Arriving in Hartist, Chester is nowhere to be seen, but the entire village is preparing to celebrate the hauling, when the legendary Hartist stone, a giant boulder that sits on the green, was hauled from the top of the hill to the middle of the village. This ritual features a dance called the Virgin's Jig, involving young men dressed as woodwows. It still lacked half an hour of midnight, and I had expected the revellers to return to the Crown and continue drinking. But to my bemusement, the entire village and its visitors seemed determined to retire to bed early. The half-sixpence of the moon had at last risen above the stratum of low cloud which had formerly obscured her light, and I had a clear view of the retreating masses. They streamed away like sand through the fingers of an open palm, until 10 minutes after the close of the ceremony, the green, and the inn below me, whose rousing roar had fallen to silence, were almost empty. The broad patch of churned, flat-beaten grass around the stone, deserted. From my high vantage, I commanded a fine prospect of the whole green, and idly I watched the people of Hartist return to their homes. Curiously, for such a hot, airless night, the curtains and shutters of the houses all around were indeed carefully closed, as one by one the lights went out. I have said the green was almost empty, and it was. But I was mildly surprised to see that it was no motley knot of laggards who loitered behind, hoping for more excitement, but instead the remaining dancers from the Virgin's Jig. Those females who were, one assumed, now condemned to remain in their pure state until next year. As if by mutual agreement, or perhaps time-honoured tradition, these now bent to the task of skivvies and street sweepers, picking up discarded food and tankards, rescuing ribbons abandoned by luckier maidens, and moving the trestle tables and burned-out torches back into the inn. The general air was an incongruous blend of dejection and anticipation, as though, disappointed of their manly prizes, they now waited uncertainly for some further development, which might be wonderful or terrible, or might not happen at all. Once their chores had been performed, this score or so of women returning to the stone, which seemed to draw them as a magnet does iron, abruptly reconvened, huddling close as frightened animals or resting birds often do. At the same time, the few remaining male watchers seemed to lose interest so far as the leftover females were concerned, and finally wandered off themselves. This I considered crassly ungentlemanly, when no doubt every one of those girls had a home to go to, and would have welcomed a trustworthy man to see her back to it. Yet the maidens still clung on, with a fearlessness which looked with every passing minute more like desperation. Many were young and comely, far more so indeed than some of those who had attracted a woodwow swain, and there seemed to be no rhyme or reason to why they had been spurned. I could not fathom it, nor why they still lingered outside in that hot summer night, in evident expectation of something they both craved and feared. 12 o'clock was fast approaching, and I fancied that in the breathless stillness I could almost hear the old gears of the clock upon All Saints Tower beginning to revolve as they prepared for the midnight chimes. The women looked at one another, looked at the stone about which they clustered, looked back towards the silver-smooth moonlit lawn of the green. Suddenly, a sort of shudder went through the group, as though someone had walked across all of their graves at once, and they scattered apart, exactly like a flock of starlings before a cat. They ran, bolted, I should say, in all directions, dispersing so fast I could hardly track more than a few. At the last moment, it seemed, their collective courage had failed them, and they could not bear, after all, to face... what? What had they been waiting for? And where were they going now? They ran, heedless and stumbling, as if the very hounds of Hades pursued them. They ran as the transfixed hare, having stayed still too long, bolts from a predator who is almost upon him. They ran, not as women do when they wish to be pursued, prettily, gaily, trippingly, but as men and beasts do when they run for their very lives, launching themselves forward with starting eyes and streaming hair, in greedy, despairing lunges, with all the speed their slight bodies could muster, yet still somehow seeming to wallow, to slow in the thick, dark air. Home they ran. And thank God, thought I, watching, that home in this small place was so close, sobbing, beating breathlessly upon doors which snatched open to receive them and bundle them in, as though the house's occupants had been crouched praying at the threshold. Within 2 minutes, every person who had stood upon Harter's Green was gone, and every window and every door that faced onto it was shut fast and bolted, except my own. It was folly alone. Well, folly mingled with curiosity about the legend of the stone that moved by itself and about what the fleeing women had been so afraid of, which kept me standing at that window, staring out into the blood-hot, moon-haunted night as the last minute ticked towards midnight. I did not know when the witching hour was, nor how I might tell in the landlord's odd phrase, when it was neither night nor morning, but I knew that anything the whole village turned its face away from, even fled, was something I must see for myself, if I could, or die in the trying. All the fear and trepidation seemed to have fallen away from me, as a snake's skin sheds and sloughs, until only its sleek new body remains. I remember wondering what I would see, and what I would be after I had seen it. As the chimes of All Saints began to shiver through the silvered gloom, I was perfectly calm. Calmer than I think I have ever been. Only my sweat-drenched silk dressing robe interposed between my nakedness and the oven-hot air. The sensation of stinging fire licking slowly at my body from the inside intensified until I felt as if I should go mad if I could not peel my own skin off like a wet shirt. But still, I stood at the window and stared. On the first stroke of midnight, there was nothing. Perhaps a sigh of wind caressed the grass around the stone, but it could hardly be called movement. On the second stroke, there was a murmur as of thunder rolling between hills many miles away, like a billiard ball between cushions. On the third, the stone shimmered liquidly, like a heat mirage. So briefly, I could not be sure I had even seen it, and then was solid again. On the fourth stroke, the enormous boulder began to rock gently upon the ground on which it stood, an infant being soothed to sleep by its mighty earth mother. On the fifth stroke, the stone rose up on its end as if pushed by a giant hand from below. It trembled a moment, in perfect equilibrium, then fell flat on its other side with a mighty apocalyptic thud. Beneath it was a great round ragged hole full to the brim with darkness. On the sixth stroke I understood that now, exactly halfway through the midnight chimes, was the moment between night and morning, and as I realised this, the black mouth directly beneath me began to boil with eyes and limbs and fur. On the seventh stroke, all of hell was let loose. I believe I used that word advisedly. It was as if every demon in the netherworld had snapped his chain and surged rampaging through the sleepy village laid out like a diorama beneath my bedroom window. These nightmarish woodwoes who crawled and loped and leapt from their prison beneath the turning stone were not the ragged dancing bears of the Virgin's jig, nor even the swinish furred devils of the Doom painting. They were something tameless, awful, magnificent. Beasts in the form of men, men with the hearts of beasts, they were both, and something more. And the sound they made as they swarmed, a frightful, keening howl, as eloquent as any wordless cry can be of fury, lust, and savage exultation all at once. As fast as the women had scattered from the stone, these things were faster, loping on all fours, fleetly as wolves, to the very edge of every house facing the green, then hideously, standing to their full height and trying the fastened shutters with clawed yet nimble, horribly human fingers, even clambering up the walls where they could to seek ingress on the first floor. This was awful enough to witness, but when the screaming began, I am certain I half fainted. At last I saw that one of the creatures had pried open a window and was hauling out the woman inside in a nightmare of shrieking and struggling. My heart rose in my throat and choked me. I could not even cry out as the creature swung the hapless girl across his broad, pelted shoulder and half dragged her away. I burned to close my eyes upon the scene, but could not. And so I saw it when he dropped her bodily a few feet onto the green and stood over her panting and huffing like a winded horse. She stopped screaming at once, in shock, looked up, and her face changed. She was not afraid anymore. Slowly, painfully, she heaved up onto her knees and elbows, and without throwing so much as a backward glance towards her family's little cottage, began crawling towards her captor again. His teeth flashed in a feral grin, and he swept her up into his shaggy arms once more. The next moment, the pair was gone. I cannot say where to. But all around me the same scene was repeating itself as the creatures breached the houses which had been insufficiently secured or purposely left open and made away with the people within. There was no doubt that these were the same as the thing I had seen last night in St. Peter's graveyard, staring up at me from the margin of the trees with silver animal eyes. So that was what must have happened to Chester. My heart tightened and my vision swam. To think of him dragged. I saw again the monster's terrible strong arms, hideous bared teeth, for every beast, even man, must eat. The women would be ravished, the men consumed. This was the vision from the Doom, agonized souls falling backwards into hell's devouring mouth, guarded by hairy demons. The heaven house of Hartest Church, sanctuary for the saved and righteous. The rock before which Mary and John had knelt praying, it was the stone, this stone. And it had not plugged the mouth of Christ's tomb, as I'd assumed, but stopped up the very jaws of hell itself. For what was the stone but a prison door, rolled back once a year when the stars were right, to let the damned have their orgy of flesh and blood with whomever was not wise or fast enough to flee. I saw it all. It had all been in the painting, and now I saw it. And I saw, too, Why that commemoration of the day the good folk of Hartest had beaten the Woodwoes back, trapped them below ground, had been quietly whitewashed away. Nobody wished to recall it. Eventually the tales split and disagreed, the dreadful memories became half-forgotten ritual, and nobody knew why, or even when, the hauling had happened in the first place. All they knew was to shut their windows, doors, and eyes until the seventh was over. Yet now, as I stared at the abysmal scene from my high window, I saw something else again. I saw that some of the shutters had been thrown back, and some of the casements stood open where they had been closed before, in houses the Woodwoes had not yet reached. I saw pale, hopeful faces and lonely eyes of women who had danced tonight without a partner in their dance. I saw the white muslin of nightgowns shimmering in the moon, and tumbled long hair and bare skin. I saw at last the welcome in the women's eyes, and I felt the blood pound like hooves in my ears. As if hearing it, as if I had cried out, indeed, one of the prowling creatures stopped dead and stood up on its two human legs. It was quite covered in deep brown hair, ruffled and shining under the moon, a feathery ringleted coat which called to mind the silky curls of a King Charles spaniel. It turned. It looked up. It looked straight at me. Stunned with horror, I could not look away. As it advanced toward me and the creatures before it instinctively cleared a path, its beast's eyes flashed silver. Its wet red lips parted a little, and the teeth behind them gleamed back at the moon. It got to the bottom of the wall, and it stared up at me, and I knew it again for the creature in the churchyard. It grasped a thick stem of ivy with its furred hands, strong as death and twice as sure, and began to climb. And I watched it with the detachment of a dead man. And as I watched, I realized that its tousled fur was just the colour and curl of Chester's hair. And at last I understood where the recognition in the graveyard creature's eyes had come from. Our gazes locked again, and I tore off my maddening rag of a dressing gown and leaned out of the window, flinging the panes wide to show myself. Chester, my friend, the Reverend Whittingstall, the supreme summit of civilization, a man who could quote Homer in flawless Greek and the Bible in the original Aramaic, howled in delight to see his friend bare-skinned in the pale gleam of the moon. Except looking down, I found I was neither bare nor skinned. Instead, my nakedness was covered, head to foot, in a silky pelt. I felt my face. The same thick, smooth fur bearded me to the eyes. Bestial strength and fierce ecstasy coursed through every cell of my body. I knew now that what bonded Chester and me, what had always bonded us closer than brothers, was not our intellect or our love of books or our superficial civilization, but instead the wild that ran in our blood like sap, because we were both made here by these creatures. Chester had been born here after all, at Hartest Hall, just up the hill. And I... Imagine the barren or neglected wife, whose arms might welcome so rough an embrace. Imagine perhaps a fresh minted bride ignored by her new husband in favour of brass rubbings. Imagine a night spent alone in a honeymoon suite at the Crown, watching these villagers' strange ritual and feeling strangely moved by it. Opening the window as midnight tolled, just to peek out, just to see if it were true about the stone. I wept for my mother, and all the lonely women who welcomed the Woodwoes in and bore and bred their bastards, for we were only ever half theirs. I wept for us, half feral children, conceived in wild darkness, raised by unsuspecting fathers, little knowing ourselves what we were until one year the stone was strong enough to pull us in. We had felt the bruteness breed in our blood and had to answer its call. And we were not the only ones. There were generations of us out there, woodwoes old and new. Every year, the barmaid had said, every year, some of the boys who went off never returned. The vanishing season, she had called it. And here was Chester's vanishing. It had been he, the creature I saw in the graveyard, not desecrating the dead, but eating the sweetmeats left there in order to survive. For what newborn animal can feed itself its first few nights in the world? That poor beast had not hurt or abducted my friend. It was he. It was he, too, who had run alongside the gig, protecting me, escorting me, if I had but known, to our mutually fated destination, not to discover more about the doom, but to fulfill its hidden prophecy. But I no longer had the words to say any of this to Chester. I no longer had words at all. I have claws now, and fur instead. I leap to the windowsill, swarm down the wall to meet him. Hands and thighs, wind and moon, beast and brother, blood, water, sky, earth. Good.